is ruled out because of the impact it has on employers who are trying to, you know, who are the people who grow the economy for us. With income tax, I suppose it has the advantage that the revenue gradually builds up, and it is, you know, you can make a progressive social democratic argument for it, particularly if
Yes.
you're also investing in, you know, things that I would consider as a social democrat to be productive public investment. But you are right. She is going to have to choose very carefully. But equally, if she doesn't do this, if she doesn't do something to balance the books, as it were, you could see a bond market reaction, which in itself would be devastating for the economy. She's got to get this sort of sweet spot, hasn't she, where she finds a tax rise which allows her to balance the books and do the wider investment that she wants, which reassures the bond market and also reassures our friends at the Bank of England that they can continue on their trajectory of slowly and gradually bringing interest rates down, and which they have been trending down slightly, which is also good, of course.
No, indeed, you're right. She has to do it in a way that she can continue without the markets, particularly the bond markets, forcing her to do things later on that she doesn't want to do. That is the challenge of the budget. Jonathan Ashworth, I thank you for coming on and talking about these things. I hope we get to do so again. Always good to talk to you. We're going to leave it there, though. That's it for me today, but I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And coming up next on Times Radio, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
And on the programme today, we'll have the latest on a rail derailment in Cumbria. And following Saturday's attack, should train travel involve more security checks for passengers? Why China has threatened a UK university, one that just happened to be researching into alleged Chinese human rights abuses? Should Andrew also lose his military medals? He's lost just about everything else, but what about the medals he won for his service in the Falklands? And we'll ask why Borough Market is clamping down on influencers after a poor review for a £9 apple crumble. And our money man, Adam Shaw, is here talking about passing money on to children without coughing up huge amounts of tax. That's later.
It's a wide and varied show. It'll start just after the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. A 32-year-old man's been charged with 10 counts of attempted murder after the mass stabbing on a high-speed train in Cambridgeshire. Anthony Williams was arrested in Huntingdon on Saturday evening. He's also been charged with actual bodily harm and possessing a bladed article. Meanwhile, Scunthorpe United says one of its players, Jonathan Ghosh, was on the train. The football club says he remains in hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Nigel Farage says there could be a general election in 2027 caused by economic collapse. In a speech, the leader of Reform UK has pointed to falling productivity and growing government borrowing. If Reform wins power, he says the private sector will be prioritised.
We will become the most pro-business, pro-entrepreneurship government that has been seen in this country in modern times. We'll bring into government, as advisors or ministers, people with real business expertise in their own sector. And we will signal what we hope and believe and what we know we need to be a change of attitude in this country.
A train which derailed in Cumbria this morning is thought to have hit a landslide. No one's been seriously hurt after the front carriage of the Avanti West Coast Glasgow to London service came off the tracks near Shap. 87 people, including passengers and staff, were on board and escorted to safety. Scotland's First Minister John Swinney says an investigation will be carried out.
Rail travel is a very safe way of travelling, so when these rare incidents happen, they have to be examined very carefully, and we're in touch with the United Kingdom government on all of these questions to make sure that passenger safety is assured.
Avanti is predicting days of disruption on that line. The Society of Radiographers is calling for stronger rules on who can be called a sonographer. There are concerns that some high street clinics carrying out baby scans on pregnant women are missing medical emergencies. and a 150-year-old bottle of beer is going to be opened and used to brew something new. Allsop's Arctic Ale, which is 9% ABV and brewed in 1875, was made to fortify Victorian explorers against the chill of the Arctic. Dougal Gunsharp, master brewer at Innison Gun in Scotland, bought a bottle for just over £3,000. He's told Times Radio he thinks it can be recreated.
Well, we've teamed up with Allsop's, who obviously are the family that originally brewed this beer. And we've worked with them to uncover the original recipe and the original brewing techniques, and we found that a lot of the materials that they used at the time are still available today, albeit not in commercial sort of quantities now, but enough for us to make the batch. So the plan is to actually very faithfully replicate the brew.
He says it should taste like a deep sherry or a Madeira. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, good afternoon. We're here until 4 o'clock, and between now and then, can you honestly imagine airport-style security working on Britain's railway network? Let us know what you think about that. We'll talk about the British University, where staff were threatened by people believed to be from China's security services because the institution had had the temerity to do some research into alleged human rights abuses in China. We'll look at London's desperately fashionable Borough Market, which is getting fed up with these influencers who clog up the place doing all their filming. And there's been quite the kerfuffle lately about this so-called humble crumble, which is highly rated by many, but not all. And influencers have been, I think the term is dissing it, Fee. It's £9 for a slice of this humble crumble.
It comes in just a very small kind of open pot, doesn't
it? Yes. I mean, I'm not being funny, but even I can make crumble.
It's quite cheap ingredients in a crumble as well, isn't it?
Can be very, very
But I'm very much liking the way that you've totally embraced the lingo of the teen and of the influencer. Give us some more, girlfriend.
No, I don't think I will. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has lost just about everything. Does he also, honestly, really deserve to lose the medal he won for his Falklands service? We'd welcome your thoughts on that. Monday's Literary Salon is up and running from 3:30, and cheeky Times and Sunday Times literary editor Robbie Millen is a very welcome guest. He's with us today. And Money Matters at 3:45, Adam Shaw on inheritance tax and how to avoid it. One way, of course, is by not having all that much money. And I don't think either of us in the studio are going to be overly impacted by inheritance tax. But who knows?
My family has never been troubled by it, Jane.
No?
And maybe this isn't the right radio station to admit that on. But many people listening will be troubled by it. So well done, you. And you want to listen after 3:30 for some top tips. I have to say that in response to your call out about people's opinions on Andrew having his medals taken away from him, the first four correspondents say no, he should keep them. He has been punished for whatever it is that he has distanced himself from, but has brought the royal family into disrepute. But what he won in terms of his service, then he won, and he should keep them.
Well, I think we all have to be, this is unfortunately rather a sophisticated, it's not that simple, is it? Because bad people do good things. Allegedly good people are capable of doing some very bad things. Life's not simple. So perhaps he should be allowed to keep that.
I'm very interested in hearing from people who served alongside him or who are currently serving in regiments where that kind of accolade is highly regarded. You know, it's something of an honour for the regiment as well as for the person who may have been awarded the honour. So I think that those people, their opinion really, really counts in this. Mm. But do keep them coming. It's 0333 003 2353. You'll be surprised to hear, but neither Jane or I served in the Falklands, so we don't know anything about that story really either. The most read stories on the Times. You didn't, did you? Or did you?
No, I was
just checking.
I was
a little bit older than me.
An opinionated sixth former at the time. I had my views.
Okay.
But actually, we should say I've got tremendous respect for anyone who's ever done any kind of military service.
Oh, too right.
So absolutely, we are not qualified to comment, really. But I would love to hear from people who do know much more about it.
We're Jane and Fee at times.radio if you want to send us an email instead of the text or the WhatsApp. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. In at number 3, Huntingdon train stabbing suspect remanded in custody. The second second most read story is of a similar theme, Huntingdon train stabbing, hero worker protected passengers from attack. And the most read piece on the Times website is Hard Up, Homeless and Alone. What's next for Sarah Ferguson? That's Hilary Rose's take on the former Duchess's future. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Also on the programme today, actually, how on earth did Peter Mandelson get that job as Washington ambassador bearing his links with Jeffrey Epstein? There'll be more on that because the Foreign Affairs Select Committee is discussing exactly that. So we'll discuss that too between 3 o'clock and 4 this afternoon. So lots happening today. A train travelling from Glasgow to London derailed in Cumbria very early this morning with four people suffering minor injuries. Here's Sam McDougall, Director of Operations at Network Rail. He said they are looking into what caused this incident.
Our attention now turns to two things. The first is carrying out a full and thorough investigation to understand exactly what's happened. Early indications would suggest that the train has struck a landslide just north of where it now stands. The train design has worked extremely well. The vehicles remained upright, albeit the leading vehicle derailed.
So let's talk to Tony Miles, who's a writer for Modern Railways magazine. Tony, tell us about that theory about the landslide or landslip. Do you believe that was the cause of the derailment?
It does seem so, yes. I spoke to people or saw messages from people who are industry experts. One or two were on the train, and they were messaging fairly quickly after it happened that the train had hit a landslide and that had what had caused the leading vehicle to derail. So I think we can be reasonably certain that that's the initial cause of the incident, yes.
And they knew that because they could see it, or because it was very early in the morning. I don't think it would have been light, would it?
It probably wasn't light at that time, but the driver certainly would have felt the way that the front leapt up as it hit it, probably, and came off the rails. So using their experience, first of all, they would have known that they'd hit something on the track. I'm certain that if it was a landslide, it will still be there behind the train, probably quarter of a mile back, and they'll have seen where the train ploughed through it. So there'll be some quite obvious evidence there for them to examine.
How often do landslides impact on railway lines? And I imagine this is a pretty wet part of the world, isn't it? And in fact, the weather had been very, very wet in Cumbria over the last day or so.
This is becoming a bigger problem, actually. On a podcast I do, we were talking to a former head of weather at Network Rail who was saying to us that, yes, it's becoming more frequent, partly because the railway, as you know, is part of it is 200 years old this year. So yeah. A lot of it's been there a long time. The Victorians didn't necessarily build their embankments and cuttings the way that you would today. So some of them are too steep or some of them are made out of the wrong material. And they certainly weren't expecting the change in climate that we're seeing now, where we're getting very intense bursts of rain rather than smaller amounts of rain over longer periods, which is able to disperse from in the ground. So these really short bursts of very heavy rainfall are something that the structures weren't designed to cope with. And so we are getting waterlogged ground, and eventually it reaches a critical point and it will slide down towards the railway.
So another significant impact of climate change then?
Definitely, yes. Yes. The experts within the rail industry who are looking at this, and you remember at the beginning of COVID, there was the serious accident at Carmont in Scotland where lives were lost. And again, the embankment has slipped down, and that caused a lot of thinking and investigation into the state of the rail network and the realisation that a lot of changes in the way rain falls, the way it then does or doesn't dry out, is affecting the railway. We've had two bits of railway this summer that had to be the trains had to be slowed down because the ground was too dry, because the clay under it was drying out unexpectedly. So it's going both ways. We're getting too much water at some times and too much dry periods in others, and the infrastructure wasn't ever designed to cope with it.
And I'm sure this is a daft question, but there's no way that Network Rail could check for possible landslides by the track before any train sets off on a trip.
Well, they're checking some of the worst bits continuously. They've got monitoring systems now in place anywhere where they're identified that there might be an ongoing issue or an area of concern. And they're getting cleverer at that now. They've got systems that can tell if a cable that works the signals, an electric cable, if it moves slightly, somehow that affects the electrons that are flowing through it. And that can even set an alarm off that it's moved slightly. So they're getting much better very quickly at detecting any changes in the ground. But of course, if it happens, there have been instances in the past where drivers have seen the ground starting to slip towards the track as they're approaching it. Fortunately, because it moves slowly, they're able to get past and then alert people before another train comes. But obviously, if it happens moments before a train gets to the situation, that there's no time to stop it. So they've just got to get more and more clever at watching how the ground is, the state of the ground, and making sure that it drains properly where it can be done.
But it would seem that, as actually with the events on Saturday, that the relevant authorities conducted themselves well this morning, and that possibly has led to the fact that there are only four minor injuries. So everybody involved today behaved in a, what would you say, in an exemplary fashion?
Well, we've seen in both incidents that the crews involved have behaved incredibly professionally. The driver on Saturday with the stabbing incident, realising that he needed to be diverted to a station and getting that message out, very, very good. The driver today, on the derailment train, pressed his emergency alarm button very quickly, which meant that it sends a message to every other train in the area, emergency, emergency, stop. And they did stop, which is good, because there would have been a train coming the other direction and it would have hit his train had it not been stopped. So again, really professional actions by the crews involved in doing the right thing, pressing the right buttons, sending the right alert messages, and making sure that what were nasty incidents didn't become much worse.
Yes, and of course we all honour the courage of the LNER employee who was so brave during Saturday's events on that train. What is the latest on what went on at Huntingdon?
There's not much more emerging at the moment, really. I think the concern more is to make sure that the people who've been injured are safe. The discussions, obviously, as you were alluding to a few minutes ago, are drifting into how can we make our railways safer. I'm not sure whether we could ever get to the point of having detection systems at every station and every platform. I think we'd probably bankrupt the nation.
Well, actually, I was going to ask, is it simply a matter of cost? I mean, in some stations that practically they wouldn't work, there isn't the space. There's so many entrances, aren't there, and different ways of accessing the station. Is it just about cost in the end?
Well, it's a cost and practicality. You've got to have somebody there, because if an alarm goes off, you might have something completely innocent, like an artificial limb that's triggered it. So you've got to have somebody at every gate that can pop across and say, oh, very sorry, sir, obviously carry on. So there are things like that. There's the fact that some stations are completely open, or you can get in through back ways, or you could just, if you were determined, you'd just go to a country platform somewhere and get on a local train to join the main train, and you'd never have gone through security barriers at a big station. It's more complex than perhaps people think, and the more important thing possibly is for people to be vigilant. We might get really annoyed at that if you see it, say, it sorted thing and the 61016 number if you're concerned, but actually perhaps particularly on Saturday, the reason that they're trying to get that into people's head is that if something is happening, then you have ability to raise the alarm. Just be vigilant. Watch for people that might be. I was going to say behave suspiciously. It's very difficult, because it's difficult to know suspicious person, yeah, or just a quirky person. But certainly, keeping your wits about you a bit is very important. There are systems there to report it, and obviously the people on the train as well alerted the driver on Saturday very quickly to what was going on, so he was able to make the right call to get to a station quickly, so that they could evacuate the train. So the passengers behaved in a very exemplary way, as well as the train crew themselves.
Thank you. Good to make that point, actually, Tony. Tony Miles, who's a writer for Modern Railways magazine. We should say that this is news just in. A 14-year-old boy was stabbed in Peterborough on Friday, which was one of three knife-related incidents in the city believed to be linked to the Huntingdon train stabbing suspect. This just in from the police in Cambridgeshire.
Well, we'll obviously be keeping our ears across that. Thank you so much for all of your texts. We've had a very, very busy deck so far this afternoon. All of you having thoughts about whether or not Andrew Mountbatten Windsor deserves to keep the medals that were awarded to him during his time in the forces. Anne says, absolutely not, Ray Andrews medals. Those were won fair and square and have nothing to do with later scandals. He did his shift. Alan says his Falklands medal is a campaign medal. He got it because he was there, which is more than can be said for the rest of his medal festooned family. Harry accepted he should keep it. And Alan says, I was in the Navy for 23 years. I have campaign medals of my own. And this one in from Ian, who is a retired soldier of 37 years service. No question that Andrew must keep his Falklands campaign medal. It marks one of his few genuinely noble achievements. But take away his para wings and commando badge, neither earned by passing those selection courses. Do keep them coming. We will try and read out as many as we can over the next half an hour or so. Coming up, why Borough Market might have significantly few influencers hanging around should you have a permit before you can critique an apple crumble on a market stall. It's a big question. Are we going to?
It's one of the biggest on earth.
Really attempt to do that one justice. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrund and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mum was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2 for 1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Now let's get ready to crumble, as Anton Deck never sang. Welcome back, Jane. A glowing review from a popular influencer can send fans flocking to whatever they're promoting, which sounds like a positive thing.
We got the viral chocolate strawberry shop. Local strawberries covered in Belgium chocolate. Are you kidding me? They have one dude pours in these chocolate chips, melts down their custom Belgium chocolate blend. You have a team in the back chopping up these local English strawberries. I don't know where they're sourcing them from, but every strawberry is perfect. And then the dudes at front that man the chocolate stations, $10 a pop too. This place is probably making a mil a day. These are one of those things where you're like, all right, it looks pretty, but like, does it actually taste good? Yes, it tastes great.
Believe it or not, some people are making a career out of that.
Can I just say, it's appalling.
It is. isn't it? London's Borough Market, camera crews and content creators crowding the walkways to get that perfect shot have been causing a bit of disruption. So now the market is reminding visitors that they need written permission before filming. Let's talk to Alistair Maddox, who's CEO of Borough Market. Alistair, very good afternoon from us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Now, just tell us a little bit about the kind of disruption that you're talking about here. This isn't people who are just going to Borough Market and are then recording something quite benign on their phones and sending it off to their mates.
No, I mean, I think it's worth remembering our primary focus is to ensure that we have a really great safe space for our visitors, for our traders, to carry out, you know, and enjoy the market. You know, any filming or taking up space when on busy days can be very disruptive. It can mean that, people can't get around the market as they would hope and to the stalls that they want to. And obviously queues or bottlenecks can be operationally challenging for us. So they're the types of things we're focusing on.
How many influencers are causing these disruptions on any given weekend?
Difficult to put a number on it. I think it's worth thinking about, you know, our filming policy is a general one. It's focused on filming for predominantly large TV crews and so on. And the aim to be to make sure that the space is safe. And it's not specifically influencers that we're focused on. It's very much more about, creating a safe space where operationally we can manage the foot traffic and also make sure that, you know, visitors have a really enjoyable experience at the market. They, not everyone wants to be in the background of a shop, whether that's on an iPhone or on a big film camera.
Sure. And so how many permissions would you be granting for film crews at any one time?
Not that many. We don't get the level of engagement that perhaps you might think. Generally, our security teams are briefed to just check in with anyone who's sort of really obviously filming. That's, you know, someone filming a mate who's talking to an iPhone, or whether that's a sort of more serious crew. We get kind of quite a few turn up, and we sort of approach them and find out what's happening and ensure that it's safe and not causing any negative knock-on effects in terms of the flow of the market. But we're really keen to engage with people. We can probably help people achieve their goals much better and in a safe way if we're part of the conversation. And we're really open to that.
Now, obviously, there's been a little bit of a doodah about the nature of the content that was being created when people were asked to stop, because what has gone a little bit viral, if indeed that is a thing, is an influencer who was escorted out of the way. He was filming a review and critique of, I think, the Humble Crumble product, which was whatever it was, salted caramel or pecan crumble or whatever, and he just wasn't being particularly nice about it. So I suppose the danger is that people think you're escorting people from the premises if they're being a little bit critical of what's on offer.
We're not particularly engaged in what the content is. Certainly didn't have any idea what was being filmed at the time. It'd be impossible for us to understand what someone's filming and if it's a negative review or positive review based on seeing someone with an iPhone and eating something at the market. There's, tens of thousands of people around. It's not something that we monitor or that we're particularly interested in. Honesty is always a really great policy for us, and we're always keen to help improve if we can.
Sure. And actually, that's the key thing here, isn't it, Alistair? Just that times have changed, and actually so many people will be visiting a market such as yours simply because they have seen people filming, you know, decent pieces of content and encouraging them to go. So it's quite the balance, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're absolutely steeped in history, and we're really proud of being the place where, you know, British food can be really discovered, and being at the forefront of new trends and new innovations within the food and produce sector. We've done that long before the advent of social media, and we'll continue to work with evolving technologies to ensure we can do it in the future.
Yep. There's an interesting text here from one of our listeners, James, who says, this is common for professional photographers. I have to get permission for going on the tube around London. Same in America. You have to book to shoot at Venice Beach, etc. It certainly makes sense. And of course, that's true, isn't it? Actually, if you are a professional film crew, you can't just stop anywhere you like in the great city of London and just get your cameras out and film. But if you are an influencer who's just using an iPhone, it may not even have crossed your mind that you would need written permission.
Absolutely. Everywhere I've worked, we've always had filming policies, and people have engaged with them very professionally and helpfully. I think, obviously, as we see a shift from what was a sort of entrepreneurial sharing content with friends and family, and then a wider following, as that becomes professionalized, obviously different checks and balances need to be in place, and that's something that we're constantly working on to ensure that we can support future ways of working.
Mm. Do you like the crumble? I'm going to put you on the spot here. It's like asking you if you've got a favourite child, but is Humble Crumble any good?
I like all of the trains equally. I'm baby with my
own. No, you.
I love my mum's custard the best.
Okay, right. Right answer. That's very good. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. That's Alistair Maddox, who is CEO of Borough Market. I mean, it is just a truth, isn't it, that in the modern world, wherever you go now, there will be somebody who stops right in front of you, gets a camera out, and tells the world about the immediacy of their situation and how they feel about it. And actually, when you're in very busy places in London, it's really annoying.
It can be annoying. But I know you don't listen to The Archers, but you do know there's now an influencer character in The Archers.
I didn't know.
No, I mean, it's got to Ambridge. That's how important influencing is. We have found a dissenting voice on the Andrew Falklands medal question. Vijay says Andrew may have been in the Falklands, but he didn't take part in the action. He was kept safe. Those medals were given to him just for being there. Vijay, I don't know how you know that, because I'm not sure what you say is true. I know I've heard it before, Vijay's opinion, that perhaps he was there in a slightly superficial way. But I've also heard people say that, in fact, he was very courageous during his Falkland service. Can you see that one there, Fee?
I can. And yeah. I've heard exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
In fact, on a radio station today, somebody making that point and saying that actually they had been in the Falklands. They weren't entirely sure whether or not the usual kind of rota had applied to the then Prince Andrew. I don't have any way of verifying that, and it was challenged when I heard it mentioned anyway. And I was in a different place, by the way, so the radio was on in the background. I don't want anyone to think that I would do anything as disloyal as tune in a different radio station myself. I covered it.
It's Times Radio. Coming up, why China is threatening UK universities over human rights research. We should be very worried about this, actually. That's an important story. That's next. After the headlines, Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Police say a 14-year-old boy may have been stabbed by the Huntingdon train stabbing suspect in Peterborough on Friday. Officers say it's one of three knife-related incidents in the city believed to be connected to Anthony Williams. The 32-year-old's been charged with 10 counts of attempted murder. He's also been charged with actual bodily harm and possessing a bladed article. People at London's King's Cross were asked for their thoughts on railway security.
Knife arches, at least it'll flag up and then let people can walk through, and people that have got something to hide, then they can search.
Attacks could be inevitable anyway. The police presence is always helps as a deterrent.
So many entrances and exits, and people ignore it, and staff will get spat and attacked.
Meanwhile, Scunthorpe United says one of its players, Jonathan Ghosh, was on the Huntingdon train. The football club says he remains in hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Nigel Farage is predicting a general election in 2027. The leader of Reform UK claims a national vote after just 3 years of the current Labour government would be driven by economic collapse. It thought a landslide caused an Avanti train to derail in Cumbria. No one was seriously hurt when the service heading from Glasgow down to London left the tracks near Shap this morning. And a pregnant British teenager has told reporters she's happy after being freed from jail in Georgia. Bella Mae Cully, who's 19 and from Teesside, had been held on drug smuggling charges since May. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
At Buy Association, we stay one step ahead of the property market, and our team of experts have identified the halo at Oval Village as London's next landmark home. This stunning development with a coveted Zone 1 postcode offers luxury living overlooking the iconic Oval Cricket Ground. To find out more about 1, 2 and 3 bedroom apartments at the Halo Oval Village, request your free brochure today. Text BA Radio Oval to 66777 by association. Ahead of the market since 2005.
It's finally happened. I found it!
Found what?
The perfect Mini! And it's part of the Mini Stock Event.
The what now?
The Mini Stock Event! Unmissable savings on in-stock models, on top of existing offers. But I've got to move fast because when it's gone, it's gone!
Go get it, pal.
The Mini Stock Event. Unmissable offers 6th to the 10th of November at your local Mini retailer. Available on new Mini stock orders placed during the stock event and registered by 31st of December 2025. Visit mini.co.uk/stock event.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in bathroom design and installation. Transform your bathroom. Book a free home visit and measure, and then let the Wix design experts help you choose from thousands of products. Book a free bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Good afternoon. We're here until 4 o'clock. We are going to talk before three to Major General Tim Cross, former British Army officer, about Prince Andrew's Falklands medal. Ian says, I think Vijay will find he's wrong. Andrew was flying in harm's way over the islands throughout the Falklands War. Ian, thank you. And we've got more messages coming in, but we'll do justice to them, or attempt to, after we've done that interview, actually, with the former British Army officer. John Pienaar has got news of his programme between 4 and 7. John, what have you got today?
Well, so, sometime around 4.30, we're expecting the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, to make a statement about the Huntingdon attack. So we'll carry that live and talk about whatever the Home Secretary has to say and the reaction to the awful attack at the weekend. And part of that conversation, I think, is going to be about maybe, I don't know, some discernment between natural reaction and maybe overreaction. And as awful as this attack was, you could say there's been some overreaction. Even if the sentiment behind it is understandable. The idea of airport-style security, for example, that across the rail network, is just seems so completely impractical.
Well, as somebody who uses, it's a frequent flyer at London's less than wonderful Euston station. Yeah. It just wouldn't work.
No, not how could it possibly? Chance. I mean, no. It's hard enough to get on a train in rush hour. As it is, imagine going through airport type security. It's just, you could rule that out, I think, on practical grounds, couldn't you? Immediately. And the idea of more stop and search across the rail network. Well, again, the police have got a problem keeping up with everyday needs like shoplifting. And just imagine also practical and principled issues. If you've got officers all over the rail network stopping people who seem, on whatever evidence, to be somehow suspicious, it's going to mean a lot of people who are men and who are black and who just fit the profile in some people's minds of what a possible attacker might look like. And some people say, fine, let's just do it and keep safe. But I think there's a real issue there, a principle which we've seen over the years. So I'm talking to Fraser Nelson, the Times columnist. I'm talking to a former police officer. And a bit later on in the show, I'm going to be looking ahead to the big election in New York City with the mayor, Azura Mamdani, is a big, big contender. The guy that Donald Trump calls a communist, he calls himself a democratic socialist. He's certainly got some pretty radical ideas. And if that happens, if he gets in, that will be quite an event. We're going to be looking at that, talking to one of his big donors.
John, thank you. It is 23 minutes to three.
Now, it's been claimed that a UK university folded to a pressure campaign by Chinese state security, blocking an academic from researching human rights violations. Documents seen by the BBC showed that officials at Sheffield Hallam said interests in China were incompatible with Professor Laura Murphy's research. The university has reversed its decision and apologised to Professor Murphy, saying it didn't make the decision for commercial reasons. Let's talk now to Luke de Pulford, who's a human rights campaigner and executive director of the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China. Luke de Pulford, very good afternoon from us. What's your reaction to this? I mean, we do need to understand quite a lot about this story to understand what the end result is.
Well, the first thing Murphy has done world-leading research into forced labour in Xinjiang, and particularly related to the solar panel supply chain and polysilicon, which he found was very strongly connected to Uyghur forced labour in the region. Now, that had caused a significant change in the policies of governments worldwide who were very worried about procuring renewables from China because of complicity with human rights abuse in the region. And Beijing didn't like this. And it was no secret they didn't like it because China Daily and other state-mandated publications were complaining about it very regularly. Anyway, a couple of years ago now, it seems as if there was an approach from somebody who seems to have been Ministry of State Security or some other arm of the Beijing state connected to intelligence, to Sheffield Hallam's recruitment office in China, where they demanded to know what Professor Murphy was working on, and they demanded that it be shut down. So far, so kind of unremarkable in a sense, because this isn't the first time that UK academics have found themselves under pressure because of their writing about China. What's unusual in this case is that the university appears to have capitulated very seriously. In fact, not only did they prevent Professor Murphy from finishing her project, which at the time was on critical raw materials and its connection to Uyghur forced labour, they also shut down her entire forced labour lab, the group of researchers that was working on this issue. And it seems as if they weren't transparent with Professor Murphy about why they did that. She's obtained a load of information. She's given it to the press finally. And we hope that the attention around this will ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Let me just read the statement from Sheffield Hallam, which says the university's decision not to continue with Professor Murphy's research was taken based on our understanding of a complex set of circumstances at the time, including being unable to secure the necessary professional indemnity insurance. Following a review, we have since approved Professor Murphy's latest research and are committed to supporting her to undertake and disseminate this important work. Can you just explain to us, Luke, what the necessary professional indemnity insurance is?
Well, I think their argument is that for researchers who are working on this kind of thing, you necessarily come up against the fact that many companies use these supply chains in China, and some of them don't really like the brand risk associated with being named in a report like those reports produced by Professor Murphy. So, for example, when she'd produced her groundbreaking work into slavery in the solar supply chain, many of the companies who were named in that report tried to complain about it. Now, anybody who knows Professor Murphy's work knows that it's extraordinarily careful and methodologically very sound and withstands scrutiny. But many companies, including those in China, have attempted to sue. So when people are doing this kind of research, you need to have insurance that can protect you against lawfare or lawsuits from people who are trying to claim defamation. So that's what the university is trying to claim. They're trying to say, we didn't have the insurance to enable you to continue this work. The difficulty with that is that the documentation that Professor Murphy had obtained via a subject access request is pretty difficult to reconcile with the university's line on this.
Sure. And so there is this connection between the number of students coming in from China and a decision taken about a resident professor's work. And we don't have to have a university degree in order to see that there may be a connection here. Obviously, very much denied by the university, and it has reversed the decision. But from your experience, just tell us what the pressure is like to balance the need to embrace that money from foreign students and the need to protect yourself from any influence that might come behind them.
Yeah, so this is a very difficult and thorny problem. And if you go back to the so-called golden era of relations, when the Conservative and Liberal Democrat coalition was signalling greater engagement with China, you can't really blame university vice chancellors from around the country for deciding that they would follow suit and trying to get more foreign fees. And part of the reason they want to do that is that universities in the UK make a loss on every domestic student. Many are only able to sustain their businesses, which these universities are, with foreign fees. So that exposes them hugely to the influence of, let's say, an authoritarian state like China, which is sending many foreign students to those universities. And I think that's the fundamental issue. We have not been over this.
But, Luke, are there other cases like this one where actually something at the university integral to the academic status and standing of that university has been changed because there's a large number of students coming in from China? I mean, we can't say that about every Chinese student, can we, that somehow they're bringing the state with them?
Well, no, we can't. The difficulty is that Chinese students who, you know, very often will just want to benefit from the UK's higher education, which is a jewel in our crown, they are being weaponized by the state in Beijing, who can signal that there are certain places that they would rather that they didn't go. Yes, in answer to your question, there is precedent for this. There was the case of Professor Michelle Shipworth, who in UCL had great difficulties surrounding the stuff that she'd been doing on China, the research that she'd been undertaking. She's not alone. Jo Smith-Finley at Newcastle, she also had a similar experience. Andreas Fulder, you know, there are many researchers who've experienced this where their research has brought them basically into conflict with Beijing's established narrative, and they have leverage. And they've shown, and they're showing par excellence in Professor Murphy's case, that they're willing to use that leverage. So that's a real problem. I think from a policy point of view, this is something that it's been very difficult for the government to deal with. I mean, we don't actually have clear rules about how these universities should engage with foreign states. And we need to have those. We need to make that really clear, because it looks from everything that's been reported that Sheffield Hallam seems to have overstepped that line, and that needs to be investigated properly.
Yeah.
But in addition to
I just want to put to you as well, before we run out of time, Luke, quite an interesting thing said by the Chinese embassy in the UK. It said that Professor Murphy's Institute released fake and flawed reports. And I think what's interesting about that to an awful lot of people listening is this is the world's second most powerful superpower lasering in on research by a single British academic. And you wonder whether or not the Chinese embassy and the Chinese state might realise how ridiculous that looks, and actually how much more likely it is that attention will be drawn to something which has been problematic, the treatment of the Uyghur people and problems of morality and ethics in supply chains.
Yeah, but, you know, Beijing doesn't brook any dissent. They don't want people talking about this. And we've seen, in fact, throughout nearly all sectors of United Kingdom institutions, they've been willing to sit upon people who have had the temerity to speak out. That includes politicians. Remember, the seven sanctioned UK parliamentarians were sanctioned precisely because they were speaking about this issue in Parliament. Essex Court Chambers, who produced a legal opinion into suspected atrocity crimes in the northwest of China, in Xinjiang, they were sanctioned by Beijing. And now we're seeing that individual academics were being leaned in upon, zeroed in upon by Beijing. So this is unfortunately not new. I agree with you. It doesn't make them look very good. If anything, it underlines that research. But the key takeaway for this is that there's a systemic problem because of over-dependence on foreign fees that the government must address to protect academic freedoms.
Sure. Just before you go, do we as consumers have any means of tracking if Chinese products made with forced labour are entering UK supply chains. How can we inform ourselves?
Well, there are a couple of websites that did seek to try to create little widgets that you could insert into your browsers to see. There are a couple of reports that I direct people towards. There's an excellent report produced by ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, called Uyghurs for Sale, which names quite a lot of brands, I think well over 50, which have unfortunately become entwined with Uyghur forced labour. Professor Murphy's work when it comes to renewables. But we've got to be much more creative about this. Government procurement needs to be much more creative about this. There are now new technologies that enable people to test whether or not materials come from that region. The broader picture for people like me, who are involved in human rights campaigning around Xinjiang, would be the human rights abuses in the region are so endemic. The abuse of Uyghurs is so systemic in Xinjiang and beyond that it simply isn't safe to procure things from that region. There's no human rights due diligence worthy of the name. So if things are coming from that region, I'm afraid that you cannot be sure that they are not connected with forced labour. So be very careful when buying anything that looks as if it comes from Xinjiang.
And how would we know realistically, Luke? Because an awful lot of things simply just say made in China. They don't go any further than that.
Well, the government's not really helping us with labelling where things come from. And in fact, disclosure requirements about where things are produced are not good enough. The US moved much further than we did on this. They passed something called the Uyghur Forced Labour Prevention Act, and that reverses the burden of proof. It says that there's such a systemic issue here that we have to assume that anything bought from Xinjiang is tainted with forced labour unless proven otherwise. That's the law in the United States. And we haven't moved that far in the UK, but I hope we do.
Good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for that. Luke de Pulford is a human rights campaigner and also executive director of the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China.
Interesting message here from Guido, who says, I studied for an MBA about 20 years ago at what he describes as a reasonably prestigious university. He goes on to say there were several Chinese students on the course. Their English was almost non-existent. And guess what? In classes, they had minders who also attended, commissars associated to the regime to keep an eye on them. All this, of course, was permitted because they paid huge fees. Interesting. It's 0333 003 2353. Next, we are going to talk about Andrew, formerly Prince Andrew, and that Falklands medal. Should he lose that, as well as just about everything else? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
You want work to be less hard work. You hear an ad for MHR, so you reach out. We connect your department systems, which leads to real-time data sharing that uncovers new insights, which empower your decision makers and triple monthly sales, which leads to high fives and awkward hugs. You say a big thank you. We say you're welcome. MHR, the science behind HR, payroll and finance. The science behind a new world of work. Discover more at mhrglobal.com.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
A former Prince Andrew could lose his Falklands campaign medal. Quite a bit of talk about that today. Buckingham Palace hasn't ruled it out. So Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor will have his last honorary rank taken from him by the MOD. We know that. He had been made a Vice Admiral for his 55th birthday back in 2015. And it seems he's going to lose that very, very soon. Let's bring in Major General Tim Cross, former British Army officer and military logistics expert. Major General Cross, can you tell us exactly who got a Falklands campaign medal? Would it go to absolutely everybody involved with the campaign, including those who didn't actually go to the Falklands?
They're quite complicated. Every operation is given a name, and then everybody who deploys on that operation gets a medal. But the deployment is the issue. And there was some controversy over whether people who, for example, deployed to the Ascension Islands should also get the Falklands Medal, as opposed to going into the Falklands itself, and indeed those who supported it from elsewhere. I think the bottom line is, in terms of the conversation, is that anybody who set foot on the Falklands Islands during the campaign got a Falklands Islands Medal.
Right. Simply. Whether they were in the catering corps or on the front line.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody who serves in a theatre of operations, particularly in a campaign like that, is, you know, the blokes who were serving on the ships. Didn't matter whether you were the chef or the captain of the ship. If the ship got hit, you were just as much a danger as anybody else.
Of course. And lots of listeners to Times Radio have made that point. And in fact, as far as we can tell, and obviously it's just the people who've messaged in this afternoon, there's overwhelming, the overwhelming belief is that he should hang on to this medal because it's one of the few rather good things that he's done. And I say rather good, it's one of the few very brave things he's done in his life. What do you think?
Well, I'm delighted to hear it. I just find it, I mean, we've got to be careful here because clearly there's all sorts of issues here and he's been accused of lots of stuff. However, he's not been found guilty of anything. And I think the way the world is dumping on him is pretty unsavoury, frankly. And I think the idea of taking this medal off him would be a disgrace. The guy served bravely in the campaign alongside everybody else and he thoroughly deserved his medal and he should hang on to it.
Yes. Can I just ask you a little bit about exactly what he did? He was a Sea King helicopter pilot. Yeah. That there is a debate, and I'm sure you're aware of it, about exactly what he did and just how vulnerable he was allowed to be. What do you know about what he did?
Well, I didn't serve in the Falklands. I was doing a master's degree in guided weapons. So every day we were on the course, we were looking at the weapons that were being used. And those weapons were being carried by helicopters as well as by ships and obviously people in the land environment and so forth and in the air. He was a Sea King pilot. And I don't know that he actually landed on the ground, but he was certainly there when the air campaign was pretty intensive. As vulnerable as anybody else. I mean, you know, he was serving in the area around the Falklands with the task force, taking off with his helicopter, delivering stuff, delivering people, supplies, etc., and so forth. I don't know specifically what he did, frankly, but the bottom line is, in a way, to be brutal about it, I don't care what he did. He was flying a helicopter in a very dangerous theatre of operations, and he thoroughly deserved to get his medal.
Yes. And I think there had been a debate about whether he should go at all. And my understanding is that the late Queen said he absolutely should.
Yeah. Yeah, there has been that debate in the same way as there has been for every member of the royal family who served in the military one way or the other. The other guy, of course, who the media loves to dump on is the other prince who served in Afghanistan as an Apache pilot. I mean, these guys, you know, served alongside their military mates and their organizations, their units, etc. And quite rightly, I think the Queen did say I think she said there's no reason why he should not go. She didn't want to stop him going. And as far as I'm aware, he was as keen to go as the others have been in these operations.
Can you just give us an insight into how serving members of the military regard the royal family? Because those of us who aren't military people, we see the royals lined up with their prodigious number of medals. And as you point out, with the exception of Princes Andrew and Harry, they haven't actually earned them in the more traditional way, have they? What do the military think of them?
Well, when you say they haven't earned them, we don't want to go down too many rabbit holes, but I think one of Harry's most content times, his happiest times, is when he was serving in the military. And he was well thought of. The guys who served alongside him almost always spoke well of him, as they did with Prince William in the RAF. Princess Anne, for example, didn't serve in the military, but I saw her a lot on operations over the years that I served. People accept them. They become part of the team. And the guys, I didn't meet Harry or Prince Andrew in their military service, but I've met many of the royals in over my time in the military. They are very well thought of. the vast majority, I'm sure you could find, if you dug hard enough, you'd find somebody in the military who didn't like them much, but the vast majority of people respected them. They liked them being involved. I mean, the greatest privilege of my life, frankly, leaving aside one or two other things, is getting my medal from the Queen, from meeting her and Princess Anne and the others, Duke of Edinburgh and so forth. Mm. I had the privilege of running the 50th anniversary of D-Day in Aramanche in France, when we had more members of the royal family on foreign soil than ever before. And I met with them, and every veteran who was there was absolutely thrilled that the royal family were there in such numbers. So yes. I think anybody who tries to disparage what the members of the royal family do with the military, frankly, wants to be put back in their box.
Well, it's quite possible that those people don't know much about the military and don't understand that connection that you've described very well there. Can I just bring in a listener called Nathan, who says, Re-Andrew in the Falklands, he was a helicopter pilot over the freezing South Atlantic, in itself dangerous. The ship he was on was an aircraft carrier and a prize target for the Argentinian Air Force and Navy. To say he was hidden from action is ludicrous, and it belittles all the others on the same ship who risked their lives.
Absolutely.
I mean, you'd echo that, wouldn't you, Tim?
Absolutely right.
Yeah. So where does this go then? Do you think we should now settle for the former Prince Andrew living a life of complete obscurity in Norfolk and simply not bothering the headlines ever again? Or do you believe that he should do the decent thing, show some level of decency and talk to the authorities about what he knows?
Well, that's a different issue, of course. My inclination is that I don't know. I don't like, you know, what I'm worried about, frankly, is waking up in a week's time to find the bloke's thrown himself off a bridge.
Well, no, I mean, none of us want that.
There's pressure here. And it's very unedifying. I know what he's been accused of, and I think it's terrible, and I'm sure he's been stupid and done all sorts of stupid things. So should he speak to the authorities? I think probably he should, is my honest answer. But should we continue to hound this guy like he's going on? No, we should not. I think he's suffered enough, in inverted commas. So and there's plenty of time for him to be reconciled. I mean, there's all sorts of people who've been through done terrible things and yet have then subsequently worked in the charitable sector, worked elsewhere and so forth, and have, you know, come back into society. I mean, there's plenty of cases of that in history. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen to him necessarily. No. He should, I think, speak to the authorities about what he knows about this, you know, terrible business.
Yeah.
But we must remember he's not actually been found guilty of anything.
No, and it's a point worth making. Thank you very much for doing exactly that. Major General Tim Cross, former British Army officer, says basically lay off now. Andrew has suffered enough. It's Times Radio. It's nearly 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
A very good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Still to come in the next hour of our programme, the Cabinet Secretary has been grilled by MPs over Peter Mandelson's appointment. Was that a political gamble? Robbie Millen, literary editor at The Times and Sunday Times, joins us to preview this year's Bailey Gifford Prize. He is chair of judges. And our money man, Adam Shaw, on how to pass on wealth to your children without paying huge amounts of tax. Let's get the latest news first with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Cambridgeshire police say they're investigating three more knife incidents that may be linked to the man accused of a mass stabbing on a train. They include the stabbing of a 14-year-old boy in Peterborough on Friday. 32-year-old Anthony Williams has appeared in court charged with attempted murder. Rail security is now on the agenda, but former counter-terror chief Chris Phillips says there aren't enough officers to patrol every train.
The transport network would be impossible to keep completely safe. It is just a part of our society. You can walk on all these small stations. British Transport Police, like every other police force in the country, do not have enough officers.
Nigel Farage says there could be a general election in 2027 caused by economic collapse. In a speech, the leader of Reform UK has pointed to falling productivity and growing government borrowing. And he claims ministers often don't have the necessary experience to run their departments. He's taken aim at the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves.
Another depressing budget hoves into view. Another tax-raising budget. Another budget that doesn't have the courage, the guts to cut public spending. And I think the level of pessimism amongst businesses, amongst savers, amongst those that have assets of any kind, has not been lower in modern times.
A train which derailed in Cumbria this morning is thought to have hit a landslide. No one's been seriously hurt after the front carriage of the Avanti West Coast Glasgow to London service came off the tracks near Shap. Tony Miles, who writes for Modern Railways magazine, has told Times Radio he thinks a landslide is a plausible scenario.
The driver certainly would have felt the way that the front leapt up as it hit it, probably, and came off the rails. So using their experience, first of all, they would have known that they'd hit something on the track. And I'm certain that if it was a landslide, it will still be there behind the train, probably a quarter of a mile back, and they'll have seen where the train ploughed through it. So there'll be some quite obvious evidence there for them to examine.
A murder investigation is underway after a man in his 70s was stabbed in Norwich. Police were called to a property in Layer Close on the outskirts of the city in the early hours of this morning. They arrested a 20-year-old man at the scene on suspicion of murder. A pregnant British teenager has told reporters she's happy after being freed from jail in Georgia. Bella Mae Cully, who's 19 and from Teesside, had been held on drug smuggling charges since May. The Society of Radiographers is calling for stronger rules on who can be called a sonographer. There are concerns that some high street clinics carrying out baby scans on pregnant women are missing medical emergencies. And Strictly Come Dancing professional Amy Dowden is to have another mastectomy this week. The 35-year-old says the surgery is not needed to treat a new cancer diagnosis. She says it follows a meeting with her medical team. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is lovely to hear from so many of you this afternoon on all manner of topics, but definitely in at number one, your thoughts about the man formerly called Prince Andrew, and overwhelmingly you think that he should be allowed to keep the things that he was awarded when he was serving in the armed forces, and that other people do. And actually, one of our correspondents, who's a prison officer, has made the point that he, in his career, has seen quite a few ex-service people end up in prison guilty of crimes, and they have been allowed to keep the medals that they were once awarded. Keep those thoughts coming. We're 0333 003 2353. If you want to send an email, we're janeandfee@times.radio. We have got cheeky monkey Robbie Millen coming in.
I'm nervous already.
Yes, but he's coming in to talk. I think he'll have his chair of judges demeanour on, because he's talking about his work on the Bailey Gifford Prize.
The Bailey Gifford Prize.
Yes.
This is the place to come for highfalutin literary chat on a Monday.
It certainly is, and he will be here after 3:30. And Adam Shaw is going to tell you about the best way to avoid inheritance tax as well. Mm-hmm. So that might be worth hanging on in there for. Now, Nigel Farage says his previously proposed tax cuts would not be possible for some time if he wins the next election. In a speech this morning, the leader of Reform UK attacked the Labour and Conservative stewardship of the economies, and he also predicted economic collapse within 2 years.
The markets are getting nervy. We've seen this with 10 and 30 year gilt yields. In fact, I think my own view is that in two budgets' time, the markets will actually force the Chancellor into what will be a genuine austerity budget, at which point the left in the Labour Party won't buy it, and it's why I still stand by my prediction that there will be a general election caused by economic collapse that will happen in 2027.
Well, that is Nigel Farage doing some manifesting there. Tom Peck is the Times political sketch writer, and he was at Nigel Farage's speech today. Hello, Tom.
Hiya.
Remind us where this was and who was there.
Well, it was at the Banking Hall in the City of London, just opposite opposite the Bank of England and by the old Stock Exchange, once Nigel Farage's old stomping ground. And I think the idea of having it in this rather grand place was that it was Nigel Farage sort of trying to be taken seriously, i.e. the old Nigel being laid to rest, if you like. And I'm not convinced that that's really the way he should be going. I mean, I've been to many Nigel Farage speeches. I have been to many, many political speeches. And I don't wish to say this with too much hyperbole, but I'm a strong candidate for the most boring speech that I have ever been to. And I never thought that I would ever say that. I mean, I've got one from Rachel Rees coming tomorrow. I never thought that I would ever say that about Nigel Farage. And I think he probably did it on purpose. But if this is the end of the naval battles with Bob Geldof, if this is the end of the constant near decapitation by overhanging tree branches on the open top bus, then a great thing has been lost. And I don't think that what is coming to replace it is what his voters necessarily want.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, talk us through the boringness of it all. No tax cuts at all?
No, well, this is, as you've explained, this was the point of the speech was essentially to say the promises that I made before the general election in his manifesto, which he deliberately didn't call a manifesto. He called it Our Contract With You. And this was him tearing up the contract, saying all those things that we said we were going to do, everybody at the time said we could never do because they were essentially £140 billion worth of tax cuts. Actually, you know, the economy's in a pretty bad way, so no, I'll come clean, we can't do them. So if he'd won that election, he would be in so much deeper a hole than Rachel Rees is currently, because his promises were even bigger. His voters would be even more let down. Mm. And so and now he's sort of capitalising on the fact that there's a government that's become extremely unpopular extremely quickly, but admitting that if he was in charge, it would be even worse.
Sure. But, I mean, he could have gone in completely the other direction, couldn't he? Because some of the things that he was promising in the contract with us, they were spicy things, weren't they? They were sexy things. They were about raising the personal tax allowance all the way up to £20,000. They were the kind of thing that people might actually have heard, gone home, got out their calculator and gone, Nigel's our guy. So he's not only not done that, he's gone down the road of, that wasn't sexy and spicy at all anyway. Here comes something completely different.
Yeah, there was no sort of clear promise in the speech that went on for nearly an hour. And he seemed to almost at points be bored of the sound of his own voice for the first time ever. It was so rambling, and there wasn't really anything in it that we haven't already heard. There was stuff about, you know, all the stuff about how net zero, he's going to deregulate the energy industry, net zero is a disaster, and so on and so forth. He keeps saying that he keeps intimating that he's going to change the way in which government in this country is done, i.e. suggesting that he will choose a cabinet, a shadow cabinet, and then a cabinet, not from MPs. And I think he was suggesting that he'll have senior figures appointed, which you can do in this country. You can put them in the House of Lords and maybe copy the American way of doing it. But he wouldn't give us any real detail on how he did it. And of course, in America, these appointees have to be approved by Congress. In this country, as happened with Foreign Secretary David Cameron, you can just shove them in the House of Lords and do what you like. He didn't really make clear quite how he's going to do anything of that nature. He certainly was asked, who will your Chancellor be? And he wouldn't answer. I mean, it was a backing away from concrete stuff and a providing of literally nothing with which to replace it.
Did he talk specifically about Brexit using the actual B word?
Yeah, he said he felt that the opportunities of Brexit had been squandered, that it was a chance to deregulate. And maybe if he had become Prime Minister in 2016, he would have done things differently. But ultimately, the opportunities of Brexit were squandered because the Northern Ireland question was so much more complex than anyone gave it credit for before the referendum. And he didn't say anything on how he might have done that differently, on how it would have been so much easier for him than it would have been for anybody, for the others, the true believers in Brexit, like Dominic Cummings, who frankly found it impossible. So,
but he's trying to cover himself, isn't he, or take cover from what does seem to be much more of a poke from Labour about the damage done by Brexit, something that they didn't really want to discuss very openly until, what, maybe a couple of months ago?
Yeah, I mean, the next election, well, he predicts an election in 2 years' time. I frankly have no idea if he's right about that. I don't think he has any idea if he's right about that. But if when the next election arrives, it will be one in which Brexit is more openly discussed, which certainly didn't happen last time round, and didn't. 2019 was a bit of a special case. If Labour is going to go into that election and say, well, Brexit was a disaster, and Nigel's going to go into it saying Brexit's great, that will at least be an honest election on the subject of Brexit, which is not what we had last time round.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure who will win that argument.
Sure. And he also spoke about representing alarm clock Britain, which isn't his phrase, is it?
No, that's a Nick Clegg phrase, which was roundly mocked. I think it's probably quite a good phrase to show that you're on the side of people who work hard and rather than people who are on benefits. But then he also rode back from this promise to maybe abolish the two-child benefit cap, although that is an in-work benefit. I don't think anyone would be surprised to see that Nigel Farage is siding with people who he thinks work hard, the people who put up Union Jack flags down the high street because they believe in Britain and they work hard and they don't like to see immigrants getting to the front of queues that they're not in. That's very typical Farage. But yes, it does seem strange that it's a Nick Clegg line, yeah.
Yes, well, Nick Clegg will probably be quite grateful for the attention because it's not really gone his way recently, has it? What about some of the other slogans? There must have been some three-word slogans there that, you know, that excited you, Tom, that you can write about in your magnificent sketches.
I mean, literally nothing. I mean, I think the sketch which I'm writing currently is going to almost be a bit of a eulogy to the old Nigel. And the arrival of this new, sensible, don't commit to anything, triangulate, become exactly like every other politician who turns to Nigel because they've had enough of the old guys and of the old way of doing things. And he seems to be so far out in the polls that perhaps he feels that that's what he's got to do. But I'm not sure it really is what he's got to do. You know, his hero, Donald Trump, won an election by promising to build a wall and get Mexico to pay for it.
Yeah.
That's what people want from Nigel Farage. They want 90 billion quid's worth of crazy, not, oh, sorry, it's not going to work.
Yep. And there have been some cracking leaders in this great august newspaper, Tom, saying that that reform need to take the economy seriously in order for anybody to really be taking reform seriously. Now, we don't want to take credit for everything here at Times Towers, but I mean, he will have focus grouped, won't he, what he has said today. So do you think he's just taken that on board a little bit too much and this will be a change of direction, a kind of change of the Nigel Farage facade, but it will be the start of something, not the end of something?
Well, if he thinks that there's an election in 2 years' time, then he has got to put a cabinet together, he's got to put forward credible policies, and the first thing he's done is admit that his last lot were not credible. And that is not a credible way to behave, in my view, because you're admitting openly that the thing that you promised last time round did not survive contact with reality. But this time round, you've got to trust me that it won't happen again. So I think that is a fundamental political strategic error of the kind that he does not usually make.
Yeah, it sounds extraordinary in the dullest possible way. just before you go, Tom, was Sarah Poachin in existence there on a kind of front bench seat anywhere or not making an appearance at all?
I arrived maybe 20 minutes before it started, and the City of London police were lifting up the drains outside the venue. I wasn't quite sure why. It's a bit of a worry. He sort of came sweeping down this grand stone staircase in the old banking hall, in between these sort of neo-Gothic columns. And earlier, before it started, just to get to their seats, the rest of the reform gang, if you like, had also come sweeping down. And Lee Anderson was there and David Ball was there. He was introduced by Zia Yusuf. I do not believe that Sarah Poachin was present. And it's quite intriguing, really, because obviously very complicated reasons, they seem to be incapable of ever having more than five MPs at any one time. Like each time a new one arrives, another one has left some sort of scandal or other. But if you are one of Nigel's gang of five, it's quite odd listening to him openly say, well, you know, I will probably have to select all my cabinet from expert outsiders, people who actually know what they're doing. I mean, it's sort of a very openly showing that you have very little faith in your own MPs, small number than they are.
Yeah.
If you look at your own party and say, well, we're going to have to find a new way of doing things because we haven't got the talent, then, I mean, everybody can see that, but he's not supposed to be the guy that says it.
No, you are. Tom, we look forward to reading your sketch enormously. And also, you win our all-time prize for the man whose shirt matches his Zoom backdrop more than has ever been possible.
Some real thought has gone into that.
So you've got this this kind of night sky behind you, and then you've got little sparkles. And you're literally merging into it, mate.
I think that was the Times Radio backdrop, which I've only put up, to be honest with you, because I'm in my spare room and I've got the washing hanging up.
Okay. Okay. TMI.
Showbiz, folks.
Thank you very much. That's Tom Peck, who is the Times' political sketch writer. His sketches are always absolutely superb, so I can't wait to read this one. It just sounds very odd, doesn't it?
Well, Dave in Newcastle says, Nigel can't win with you lot. And although I'm not a natural reform voter, Fee, I do see the point that Dave is making there. Well, Tom alluded to it. Now he's gone all sensible. Nigel Farage is boring. When he wasn't sensible, he was offering us all sorts of enticements.
He was outlandish.
He was crazy and outlandish.
Yeah.
So where does that leave us?
I don't know. Maybe he was just having an off day. Maybe he's on his period. Who knows?
Good Lord. I think we'll leave the last word on Andrew and his Falklands medal to John, who says, good afternoon. I think only civilians would think about taking a campaign medal away from someone who served. Right, we hear you. We understand what you mean. It is Times Radio. It's 18 minutes past three. And in a moment, we're going to talk about how on earth Peter Mandelson was appointed as US ambassador. And I just want to say before somebody WhatsApps in again, yes, we are, neither Fee nor I would necessarily have appointed Peter Mandelson to the podcast at Times Radio either, would we? We just want to say that.
Well, I don't think we were asked.
Well, we weren't.
For our opinion.
Had we been asked, we would have said, exactly. Right, it is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire as they take a deep dive into the latest Westminster wrangles, reveal insider conversations and bring you intelligent analysis, authority and insight.
What happens now? What happens today? What happens tomorrow?
No party loyalty, no spin. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs. And a smart meter can help. Barry Henderson is the owner of Henderson's Restaurant in Edinburgh and has been using his smart meter as part of his efforts to waste less energy and be more sustainable.
The smart meter definitely has made us more conscious of our energy use, and we can modify our operation to help just be more efficient. As a vegetarian business, lots of our staff are vegetarian and very environmentally conscious, so using energy efficiently is definitely a key core value for us. It's definitely helped us save money, and it's also helped us be more sustainable, able to focus on where we're using electricity and become more efficient. I genuinely do recommend smart meters to other businesses. Like, I think it just gives you a more accurate picture of how you're using electricity and energy.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Those who are curious feel an urge to travel, to explore the world. At Viking, we create voyages for the thinking person because travel enriches the mind and connects cultures in meaningful ways. With small, modern, all-veranda ocean ships that were designed to bring you closer to the destination, discover the world's iconic cities and quaint villages. Exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wickes, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
Times Radio, 20 past three, and good afternoon to Tracy. He says, until I started listening, I just didn't realise politics could be so interesting. There you go, you see. We've won over Tracy to the brilliance and the confusion and sometimes the quite epic qualities of British political life in 2025. Tom Peck, I thought, brought to life what was clearly a somewhat turgid event featuring
Nigel Farage this morning. Now we move on with the head of the civil service who has defended the vetting of Lord Mandelson as ambassador to the US. This gentleman, he's called Chris Wormald, told MPs that because Mandelson was a political appointment, no one was able to ask him to his face if he had the capacity to embarrass the government.
So there was no interview for Mr. Mandelson. It was done as a direct appointment by ministers, as Oliver has described, and therefore there was no panel interview. That was the normal practice for direct ministerial appointments.
Well, instead, the head of the Foreign Office, Ollie Robbins, told Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee that Lord Mandelson had, get this, filled in a form.
An external appointee to the senior reaches of the service will always be asked to fill in a conflict of interest form. Very happy to share a copy of that standard form with the committee if it would help. It's an opportunity for the candidate to set out the issues that they think that might actually raise or potentially raise or perceived as raising a conflict of interest. That process was completed in Lord Mandelson's case.
Oliver Robbins. Well, let's bring in Roger Boyce, who's the Times diplomatic editor. So this was a cock-up, wasn't it, really? Let's just be honest about it.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, it is difficult to know. I've been through a vetting process when we were going to lunch with one of the former heads of, or then serving heads of the Secret Service. Mm-hmm. And you have to go through, you know, so you meet a couple of people in a hotel lobby and they ask you questions, which they could have done by telephone if the Chinese hadn't been listening. They don't lead you to the kind of area which they would consider to be controversial, if you see what I mean. They just kind of ask you about what jobs you've done in the past and where you've traveled in the past and these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And they don't try and frame the discussion, so it leads nowhere. Yeah,
does it allow you?
If it's a political appointment, right, then they already know their masters want this guy.
Yeah, yeah? And that's the problem here, isn't it? That this was a political appointment.
Yeah,
are ambassadorships always political appointments, particularly ones like that very prestigious position in Washington?
Well, it's overwhelmingly Washington political. I mean, for example, James Callaghan sent Peter Jay, who's to be the Times economics editor, and who coincidentally was married to James Callaghan's daughter.
No, you know, just a coincidence.
Just these things happen, you know.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
It's a very political appointment. But we've had professionals recently who've got into deep water too sometimes by kind of indiscreet comments about the first Trump administration and so on. It's just difficult. It's just difficult. But I think Paris probably gets vetted in that way. I mean, that's to say that there can be political appointments to Paris and they then have to go through some similar process. But the whole thing is so genteel and so, you know, recklessly stupid, really.
This was a time, obviously, when they needed to try something a little different. Donald Trump is mercurial, and that's being quite generous. Mm. He's unpredictable. He's deeply, deeply peculiar on any number of different levels, and he's up to all sorts of other business outside his minor sideline as the President of the United States. So maybe it was worth trying somebody who might be able to find a way to communicate with him. Do you understand why the appointment of Lord Mandelson might have seemed like a good idea?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, Mandelson had trade experience. He understood European Union stuff, so he could put that into the weave. But mainly his job was to get us out of horrible tariffs that Trump was essentially weaponizing around the world, and he kind of succeeded in that. That's to say, We weren't given as rigorous, an imposition as other countries were, and it happened quite fast. What we pay for that, it's not really quite clear yet, because quite often what you're given is not always what you get when you're dealing with Trump. So we'll have to see. What I mean is, I wouldn't judge Mandelson to be a brilliant success just yet. And now not at all.
No. But even though it might have seemed like a good idea to take a chance on him, his links with Epstein were known. It's not as if this came out of the blue.
Mm.
It had been well documented that they were friends and they'd spent periods of time together. And those emails between the two of them, there's real affection expressed by Mandelson towards this absolutely appalling character.
Mm.
Surely Claxon should have been going off all over the place.
Well, or the view might have been taken, well, Epstein was in this circle, which included Donald Trump, at least peripherally, and indeed Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, as he now is. They were all in good company, kind of thing. You know, it might have been a kind of weird man's thing, kind of. I mean, I think there was one calculation with Mandelson, which is that he's gay, and therefore could not, within the limited imaginative framework of the vetters, have been involved in any kind of heterosexual racket, you know, massage.
No, but I mean,
that's a
depressing conclusion that they reached on any number of levels, not least that there are many very decent gay men who would have definitely questioned what was going on around them in that sort of setting.
Yeah.
Very peculiar and incredibly, just deeply upsetting and peculiar. Let's just leave it at that. In terms of the absence of a British ambassador to Washington at the moment, are we suffering because there isn't anybody in that role at all? And who might eventually fill that role?
Well, right at the beginning, the hot favourite was Karen Pierce, who had been ambassador to the United Nations, and who Trump, inexplicably really, but you never can tell why these things happen, but he seemed to like her. And one of the skills she has is a kind of convening skill. Because she was at the UN, she understood how to play off different parts of the global south, how to get consensus, performed well in general, in the General Assembly and in the Secretariat. And she's quite a, you know, and she gets around. So she was, you know, even on paper, she was good. But, you know, as we know from Trump, you know, being good doesn't necessarily push you to the front of the queue. So the question is really, what would we get? What would we get out of a skilled professional diplomat in the ambassador's role rather than a political one? And the answer is, I suppose the answer is we can steer. We can perhaps steer the administration away from certain choices, either choices towards war or choices that will hurt us along the way. I mean, the main priority of any American, any British ambassador to America is to keep Trump engaged in NATO. So it has to be someone who understands the military and the defense structures and how to talk to Trump about those issues. Mm. But having said that, I don't think the American ambassador to Washington does a lot of talking with the president in general. They are a go-to person, and they do talk to a lot of people in the administration. But to Trump himself, not so much.
Thank you very much. That's Roger Boyce, who's the Times diplomatic editor.
Coming up, this year's winner of the Bailey Gifford Prize will be announced tomorrow. Robbie Millen will tell us who's in the running. We're going to get highfalutin, aren't we, in our literary salon? Please join us. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Pete. Good afternoon. Cambridgeshire police say they're investigating three more knife incidents that may be linked to the man accused of a mass stabbing on a train. They include the stabbing of a 14-year-old boy in Peterborough on Friday. 32-year-old Anthony Williams has appeared in court charged with attempted murder. Meanwhile, Scunthorpe United says one of its players, Jonathan Ghosh, was on the train and is in hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Nigel Farage is predicting a general election in 2027. The leader of Reform UK claims a national vote after just 3 years of the current Labour government would be driven by economic collapse. In a speech, he's pointed to a rise in government borrowing and given his analysis of the UK's economic problems.
We've been suffering from poor productivity going back for the best part of 20 years. We convinced ourselves that by importing masses of cheap, unskilled foreign labour, that somehow that would be good for our economy. Well, it was good for the wage bills of big companies in the short term, but catastrophic when it came to training and education for our own workforce.
And a train which derailed in Cumbria this morning is thought to have hit a landslide. No one's been seriously hurt after the front carriage of the Avanti West Coast Glasgow to London service came off the tracks near Shap. 87 people, including passengers and staff, were on board and escorted to safety. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious!
At Oddbox, we rescue farm-fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SEG tariff.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in bathroom design and installation. Transform your bathroom. Book a free home visit and measure, and then let the Wix design experts help you choose from thousands of products. Book a free bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Sunday Times Get Britain Reading campaign. Sign up online and pledge to read for at least 10 minutes a day.
Charlie. Red light's on. I know you've been away for a week. Do you want me to talk you through the basic steps of broadcasting? Okay, we're on. Be careful. Time to enter our literary salon. The Bailey Gifford Prize, which recognises excellence in non-fiction writing, will announce its winner tomorrow.
Yes, you're on as well, Robbie.
What's happening? Robbie Millen is the literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. You know, Bromley Hospital Radio was more organised than this. He's also chaired the judges for the prize.
Oh, yes.
Yes, a very good afternoon to you, Robbie. So that is quite an onerous task. Have you had to read all of the books?
It's a little bit of extra reading, but I'm paid to do it, so I'm not going to complain. It's not the salt mines, is it?
No, not at all.
It's just I would do it anywhere. I'd do it for nothing.
And how is the judging gone? Well, don't say that. That's foolish.
Yeah, so that is idiotic. Yes. No, do you know what? So we've actually had our final judging meeting. Yes. I can't tell you who's won because that's announced tomorrow evening. But I think I can say the winner was unanimous.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's very strange, you know, when you get six people together in a room and, you know, very different tastes, some very, very literary, others a bit more sort of into history and whatnot. And all of a sudden you converge on the same book and you think, how did that happen?
Yes.
How did it happen?
Yeah, well, now I feel like I can't really ask because you can't tell us who the winner is. But let's go through the shortlist.
Oh, yes. Should we do it alphabetical order? In that way, there's no favouritism.
What a good idea.
Should we start from the top then? So, I mean, the first one, Jason Burke, The Revolutionists, which it sounds a bit heavy. It's a big fat volume, but it's about terrorism in the 70s. I don't know why I'm laughing, because it's actually there are bits in the book which are amusing, because it's culture clash between Western far leftists who sort of went to places like Yemen to train with various Palestinian groups and sort of different social mores about exactly how you treat women and such like. But it's a really powerful book, immense research, globetrotting sort of research, just looking at the rise, because you think the 70s, it's the age of the kind of almost like the celebrity terrorists in the sense that the spectaculars with a hijacking of aeroplanes, and it was all very much about publicity, and then it kind of fizzles out into the 80s, and then we're sort of into the age of Islamist terrorism.
Yeah, but that sounds fascinating.
Yes, I mean, it's a sort of serious book, well-researched. Jason Burke is a Guardian journalist. He knows what he's doing. We didn't hold that against him.
No, of course.
That drawback.
Let's move on to...
What, that he knows what he's doing?
Helen Garner. Move on quickly, kids. Move on quickly.
Oh, yes.
So this is Helen Garner's collected diaries.
Yes.
And she's a real Australian literary sensation, isn't she?
Exactly. It's called How to End a Story. It came out earlier on in this year in the UK, and I hadn't quite clocked how good it was. Because you think, do I want to spend 800 pages inside the mind of someone who sits at their desk for a living making stuff up? But it's terrific. It's really powerful because it's a mixture of the, you know, inside an author's mind, the creative process, the self-doubt, the self-loathing, the kind of moments when you get a breakthrough, the bad reviews. But it's also... if we can go a bit lower, a bit more gossipy, about the breakup, particularly of her third marriage. She's married a man who turns out to be an utter swine, also a novelist.
That's terrible.
So, you know,
it's
advice...
very surprising, isn't it, Jane?
Yes.
It's a story never told.
No.
Has he told his story?
No, he claims never to have read these diaries.
Oh, right.
Okay. Which who knows? Mm. Although apparently she says, actually she believes him because he's never bothered to read any of her work.
Oh. Why did she marry him? He doesn't sound like a good bet.
Well, you're there from the beginning when they first meet. And she sees this man across the room and she jokes with her friends. God, look at that. Mm. God, who would marry that? And a few pages later, they're dating.
Good Lord.
Yeah. I know, women are strange creatures.
Yes, we are. Thank you for noticing. Let's move very quickly on to Richard Holmes, The Boundless Deep, Young Tennyson Science and the Crisis of Belief. Now, you're going to have to sell this one to me, because to be honest, Robbie, when I see a title like that...
Oh, yes.
I find it a little bit too intimidating.
It's a bit like homework or... Yeah. Do you know what, though? Richard Holmes, very distinguished literary biographer. He's such an elegant writer. He does it beautifully. And this essentially, because when we think of Tennyson, we think of him with that big beard, and you think of the Charge of the Light Brigade, and it's all very stodgy and Victorian. So what Richard Holmes is trying to do is strip all of that back, get rid of all that, and see him as a young man who was interested in science and things like that, because you remember that he was coming of age, all these geological discoveries, he had this crisis of faith, God doesn't exist, he has the death of his best friend, and then there's also mental illness stalking his family. His father was a completely bonkers, dangerously bonkers. So he had all of these things going on in his life. So it's really trying to show Tennyson as this kind of attractive, vulnerable young man full of ideas, buzzing with ideas, and he does a great job of it. But yeah, you're right, the kind of later Tennyson, you think, oh my goodness me,
yeah,
very heavy. But really, James Marrett, who reviewed it, called him Richard Holmes because of this job in sprucing up the young Tennyson, the kind of the Trini and Susanna of literary biography.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's a good comparison.
But Richard Holmes is a beautiful writer, yeah. Beautiful writer.
We're halfway through.
Yes.
Let's move on to Justin Marozzi.
Yes, so this is Captives and Companions, a history of slavery and the slave trade in the Islamic world. Now, what drew the judges, including me, to this book was that we now know a lot about the Atlantic slave trades, the one from sort of Africa to the West Indies and the American South and Latin America. This focuses on a much longer period of time, which, you know, slavery still exists in parts of northern Africa, places like Mali and Mauritania, to look at the slavery in the Islamic world. So it takes it right up to date with, you remember the Yazidi, those poor people in Syria being sort of enslaved. And it was part of a longer tradition. So Justin Marozzi, I think, has done quite a brave thing in sort of taking this subject, looking at slavery across this, over sort of, I think it's like 1,500 years. But he's done it in a very scholarly way. But he also is a great storyteller, lots of panache in the stories. And I think I've been on it before and couldn't stop talking about eunuchs for some reason. If you want to know how eunuchs made, this book will tell you how.
Do you know, Robbie, I remember that well.
Yes, yes, I haven't forgotten that either.
Let's move very quickly to Adam Weymouth, Lone Wolf, Walking the Fault Lines of Europe.
Yes, now, I think this is an absolutely delightful book. So Adam Weymouth, he heard about a wolf, had one of those tracking collars put on it. So he decided he would follow in its footsteps, see where it had been. So it's a kind of a bit of an adventure story, a bit of travel log going across Slovenia, northern Italy, a bit of Austria, finding what did this wolf see. So there's kind of moments you realise, oh, the wolf must have had to run across this motorway or take a detour. So you got that. What was the wolf doing? There's always...
How far did the wolf go?
Because it was like over 2,000 kilometres.
That's incredible.
They can go like the clappers. And the reason why, there must have been love or...
scent.
Lupine love. Is it lupine? You know, wolfy love. So he does discover this lovely lone wolf. He does find a lady at some stage. So there's a bit of that, but it's also about ecology, environmentalism, rewilding. I hadn't realised so many wolves are in Europe now. You know, he talks to farmers who hate the idea of these great big beasts walking around.
Mm. Well, I like the sound of that, especially if it's a happy ending and he finds Lady Lupine love at the end.
This is literally non-fiction. There's never really a happy ending.
Do you know what? The theme that is binding
like real life.
Yeah, all of these books is actually pain, isn't it? They are books.
Do you think so?
Yes, I do.
It's a bit neggy.
No, it's not neggy. It's just realistic.
Yeah.
And we're going to end with the enigma of Muriel Spark.
Yes, this is called Electric Spark, this one. I love Muriel Spark's novels. And if nothing else, it's brilliant biography by Frances Wilson, has sort of set me out reading some of her Muriel Spark's early stuff, like The Comforters, Memento Mori. And it's, again, it's like Helen Garner's book. It's really a portrait of ghastly literary men, because Muriel Spark, when she was a young woman, used to run the Poetry Society, and all these creepy sort of balding men would hit it on with her. And she was this kind of marvellous spitfire of a personality, full of energy. And it's trying to, it really focuses on her younger life. You know, what were her inspirations? She worked at Bletchley Park during the war, so she was interested in codes and things like that. And it really brings her to life. And it's funny.
Do you think that the modern literary man has managed to move away from that rather grim image of the narcissistic, difficult, eccentric brilliance?
There's a question. I could do a segue, if you like, because I'm reading another book at the moment, coming out in January, Julian Barnes's book called Departures, which he says on page 5, I'm not breaking any confidences here, it's going to be his final book. Although he has a reputation for being a very nice man, not one of the creepy men. But no, I think generally, I think people are much nicer to each other than they used to be. Ignore social media, which, you know, cesspit, everyone's horrid. I think people, the relationship between the sexes, unless I'm wrong, is much more, you know, civilised.
Well, don't look at me.
You were giving me a cold eye.
That's just my face, Robbie.
I get that every day. Yeah. I'm in therapy.
Yes.
It's kind of working. It's kind of not. No, but I just think there's such an old trope, isn't there, of the eccentric genius.
Absolutely.
Who can, you know, tell you something about the world from his, you know, position of lofty intellectual power. And actually, just as a younger woman, I just couldn't bear to read stuff from those men, because it actually didn't ring true.
Yes.
It didn't really join the dots.
Do you know what? I think that's all sort of out of fashion. I don't think people turn to novels now for, you know, a grumpy man to sort of lay it down.
Yeah, I agree.
I think so, anyway.
Yeah. So it's good it's
Unless
changed.
You're looking at me. Am I one of those bad
No, you're not. You're not one of those. But you're bad, but in different ways, really. You're good bad. Is Julian Barnes' departures that kind of, you know, I'm looking into the abyss and this is what...
Well, there's a bit of his sort of health prospects because he had a cancer diagnosis. But it's also, he's sort of... It's sort of one of those hybrid books where you have to work out, I'm only halfway through, which bits are fiction, which are sort of memoir. He's playing a little game with us about how we know stuff. Okay. Can I tell you about another book that I've become completely obsessed by?
Yes, you may.
Now I can't remember the name of it.
Well, I think I can.
Oh, yes.
Is it called Shell Shock Nation?
Exactly, because I love so... Thank goodness I've got prompts here. By this historical called Orwin Turn. It comes out in January. It is terrific, and it's a social history of Britain between the wars. And Orwin Turn is very good on things like what people were reading, what they were listening to. So I ended up listening to Gracie Fields. Do you remember? Well, no, we don't remember Gracie Fields. It's before our era.
Give her a break. Yeah, so,
but in 1934, yes. She recorded a song, What Can You Give a Nudist on His Birthday?
Oh, my dad was born in 1934. How old do you think we are?
But you might remember Gracie Fields, Rochdale's Finest.
Yes, is she the one who went to a Mediterranean island to see out her days? I can't
did
remember.
Did she? What, I don't know if
one
that's
of those
old.
Fabulous crooners of that age did. Yeah.
But you remember George Formby as well.
Yes.
Of course you can, because again, you know, our culture's lost something now. Because you remember his great songs with My Little Ukulele in My Hand from 1933, My Little Stick of Blackpool Rock.
When I'm Cleaning Windows.
Yes, which was apparently banned by the BBC, but Queen Mary, stern figure, loved it.
And did she?
She did. And he blew a little I blew a little blast on my whistle too. Oh, nothing going on there. No innuendo.
We've moved on from the Bailey Gifford.
I know. Sorry, yeah.
We certainly have, yes.
Do you want another one?
No, just one more.
No, I became very excited by the existence of a man called Douglas Bing, who was a kind of a drag act. He used to sort of a female impersonator in 1931. He did a song called I'm One of the Queens of England, which the verse was... he'd be reincarnated, a former monarch, though he's uncertain which one. I don't know who the hell I was or what I may have been, but one thing's very certain, I was not the Virgin Queen. There we go.
I've just Googled it, and Gracie Fields went to live on Capri.
Did she now?
I knew she'd gone somewhere. Also, left Rochdale, unaccountably,
yes,
and
no
went
yes.
to Capri.
Wish she could be as nudist as she liked, couldn't she?
Right. Well, it's been an absolute joy. So the Bailey Gifford Prize is announced tomorrow. Yes, that.
Yeah, tomorrow evening.
Yes.
Tomorrow That's evening. The serious thing,
okay.
Yes.
Is it a gorgeous star-studded ceremony?
Well, no, because I'm there. But no, it is Central London, all the literary world's greatest people. It's kind of a warm-up for the Booker Prize, which is next week. But this is better than that. They're calling the Booker Prize... the Bailey Gifford for fiction now. We're so preeminent now.
Gosh, it's very competitive, isn't it?
It is,
the world
isn't it?
Of book prizes.
It really is.
Yeah, we should steer well clear. I don't think we need to be concerned. Robbie, thank you very much.
Oh, yes. Am I going now?
Has that brought that segment to an end? It certainly has. And we'll review that in a focus group and we'll let you know whether your services are needed again. Glyn says, I don't think of Tennyson at all. Glyn, this isn't the programme for you.
That's a little harsh, isn't
it?
It
is harsh, but Glyn is one of our regular listeners.
Oh, she should read The Kraken. Do you remember that? We would all have done it at school about a big sea creature. There's a lot going on there.
I think Glyn's a man, actually.
Oh, sorry.
But anyway, right, let's, for Pete's sake, move on.
I thought it was Glinda. Sorry, apologies, Glyn.
We are about to unpack the legal options for reducing inheritance tax. That is next. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
But you might remember Gracie Fields.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism
on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Gracie Fields got you thinking. Sylvia says, Robbie is a joy. Yeah, don't encourage him, Sylvia. Gracie married her handyman, Gardner. I think he was called Boris, and they lived happily ever after. Right. Paul says, Gracie Fields, my 1929 Calcutta-born mother was called Sally after one of her songs. And as a teen, she sang on All India Radio before coming here after partition to study voice in the country of her mother. That's fascinating. Thank you for that. We've loved hearing from you this afternoon. Actually, it's been very busy. 0333 003 2353. If you're not Glyn and you just want to insert an acerbic remark between now and 4 o'clock.
Yeah, Glyn has retexted to say, I'm not sure who should be more offended by that literary chap, Fee or me. Glyn, don't be offended by him at all. But I think for one nanosecond, it did cross Robbie's mind that maybe I am a little older than I look.
I think he just thought, I mean, most people make the assumption that you were a land girl because you're so sort of burly. Anyway.
Do you think you could be away again next week?
No, I can't. Adam Shaw is here with our personal finance.
What is such a downturn now?
Not at all. Inheritance tax is something that so many people talk about, lots of people care about, but how many people actually are vulnerable to paying it?
That's a question to me?
It is. Okay. You, Adam Shaw.
OK. Very, very few. I think 4% of estates end up paying inheritance
tax. So 96% of estates.
Good maths. Absolutely.
Yes, okay. 96%
mean they don't. It raises a decent whack of money for the Chancellor.
Right.
I think it's 6 billion quid. So okay. Those that do pay an awful lot.
But they're wealthy.
They are wealthy.
Yeah.
But I think there's also something more than money going on here. And it's a deep sort of emotional thing that people feel they want to pass on the things they've managed to save to their nearest and dearest. And that's why it's always a political hot potato, this, even though it might make sense to tax higher IHT or more people could fall under that bracket. Actually, it's very unpopular, much more unpopular than you'd imagine when you look at the numbers who's actually liable for it.
Yes, and that's so why it's just the principle of the thing.
And that's completely understandable. You want to save for not just yourself, for your children. You think, I've spent my life saving this thing. I'd like to pass it on. Why can't I pass it on?
Okay.
And therefore, it becomes difficult.
So the magic figure where inheritance tax kicks in is...
£325,000 is the sort of basic bracket, but it's actually higher than that. Because if you do a bit of fancy footwork amongst... It's not the most romantic things to say, but darling, I'd like us to marry because it's great for our inheritance exposition. That is actually a good reason, because you can pass on everything to your spouse. And then if you own a home...
Completely free
of inheritance tax. There's also a residence nil rate band, which gives you a little bit extra. So if you then, one partner died, passed everything to their partner, that nil rate ban gets passed on, effectively, the maths works out. You could sort of pass on £1 million without any inheritance tax, which is a big whack of money.
Would that include the value of a home?
Yes, that would include part of the value of that home. There's a residence nil rate band which you can pass on. But you can't just, and I think a lot of people do feel this, I've got a home, I'd like the kids to have the home, or to give the kids the home before you die. I can explain what ways perhaps you round that, mm-hmm. but you can't just give it away like that.
No, because they'd see you, well, they've seen you coming and they've stopped it happening.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you can do it, but you pay tax on it.
Yes, quite. Okay. So you can, though, insure yourself against having to pay it.
Yes, it's called a whole of life policy. They've been around for a long time. I think they were first brought in the 1700s, these things. And it is just effectively, I mean, before that, you insure yourself for a holiday or whatever, a specific period of time. But a whole life policy insures you for your whole life. And when you die, it pays out. So what you could do, if you're trying to look after those you leave behind, is go, well, I'll pay the insurance premium whilst I'm alive. Mm-hmm. And when I die, that insurance policy will pay out a lump sum, which you've designed to cover the inheritance tax bill. So that'd be very generous of you. You're taking the cost. And if you were doing that, usually they're written in trust, because the problem can be your relatives get hit with a huge inheritance tax bill and they can't get the money because it's not been legally sorted out. If you write it in trust, it stands outside your estate. The money can be paid straight away, and your relatives can pay off the inheritance tax bill before all the legal machinations have gone through.
Jenny makes a point on behalf of her generation. She says, I think the government's going to have a hard time getting money out of our lot. I'm 44, no savings, and I doubt we'll ever pay off our mortgage. So they better get the most out of people while they can. I can see where she's coming from.
Well, and her amongst most people, as we were saying, this isn't actually something which affects most people. But I think there's something else going on here. Not, I wouldn't say most people, but very, very many people are worried about it. Really, it doesn't apply to, and it's the sort of principle thing. I've saved it. It's mine to pass on.
What about Tim's point? He says, a single person with kids has a limit of 325K plus 175 if you have a house. Yeah, that's not wealthy. Most houses in the South are more than that. Maybe only 4% pay it now, but in a few years, it'll be more like 50.
Well, I've not seen the figure 50, but certainly he's right in saying that what's happening is that this, amongst many other tax brackets, you're effectively getting a sneaky tax rise because they're not moving the bracket at which you start paying, so that each year inflation goes up and you might earn more. Therefore, you've been pushed into a higher tax bracket, even if you're not really any wealthier because you've only just matched inflation. So that's absolutely the case. Mm. And house and home prices are rising very strongly over the long term. So, yes, I think more and more people will go into this bracket, but we're not there yet.
And when very, well, super wealthy people die, we often hear, oh, they're not paying inheritance tax because there's a trust, you see. Is that just something the rest of us could never do?
No, discretionary trusts, you can do them. It's not just for the very wealthy. It also gives you some control of how that money is spent. You really want to take advice because it gets complex really, really quickly, and it can end up costing you more than actually paying the tax. But you sort of pay 20% IHT, the tax, up front, and then you pay an annual amount, and then there's an exit fee. It is a way of actually saving quite a lot of tax for some people, not just the billionaires.
Interesting. Thank you, Adam. Adam has written a brief with loads of details for us. You can find it at www.themoneydoctor.tv and follow him on the socials. It's at Adam Shaw Biz, B-I-Z.
Just a final update. Gracie Field was married three times to Archie Pitt and then Monty Banks. And then after a period of shock and loneliness in 1952, Fields married for the third time. Her new husband was Boris Alperovici, a long-time resident of Capri. Our producer today was Rosie Cutler. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Burly indeed. It's John Pienaar with Drive. Enjoy your evening when you get
to it. You might remember Gracie Fields.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The suspect in the Huntingdon train attack is being linked to three more incidents in Peterborough, including the stabbing of a 14-year-old boy. And passengers have escaped with minor injuries after a train in Cumbria was derailed by a landslide. And coming up, we're going to be heading to the House of Commons live, where the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is going to be delivering a statement on the train stabbing at the weekend. And Reform's Head of Policy, Zia Yusuf, will join me to discuss his party's new economic approach.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Police say a 14-year-old boy may have been stabbed by the Huntingdon train stabbings suspect on Friday. More details from Times Radio's Cara Bentley.
Cambridgeshire police say it's one of three knife-related incidents in Peterborough on Friday and Saturday, believed to be connected to Anthony Williams. The teenager was stabbed in the city centre on Friday evening and taken to hospital with minor injuries. There was also an incident in a barber shop. Williams, who's 32, has appeared in court charged with attempted murder. He's also been charged with actual bodily harm and possession of a bladed article. Meanwhile, Scunthorpe United says one of its players, Jonathan Ghosh, was on the train and is in hospital with non-life-threatening injuries.
A train which derailed in Cumbria this morning is thought to have hit a landslide. No one's been seriously hurt after the front carriage of the Avanti West Coast Glasgow to London service came off the tracks near Shap. Sam McDougall, Director of Operations at Network Rail, says they're looking into the cause.
Our attention now turns to two things. The first is carrying out a full and thorough investigation to understand exactly what's happened. Early indications would suggest that the train has struck a landslide just north of where it now stands. Train design has worked extremely well. The vehicles remained upright, albeit the leading vehicle derailed.
Nigel Farage is predicting a general election in 2027. The leader of Reform UK claims a national vote after just 3 years of the current Labour governments would be driven by economic collapse. A Premier League footballer was allegedly threatened with a gun on a street in North London by a leading football agent. That agent, who's in his 30s, has acted for a number of top-flight players. He was arrested following the incident in Barnet in September. Scotland Yard says another man, believed to be a relative of the footballer, was also threatened. An American teacher and his teenage son have been killed by wasps while zip-lining on holiday in Laos. 47-year-old Daniel Owen and Cooper, who was 15, were stung by hundreds of what appeared to be Asian giant hornets. A doctor said their whole bodies were covered in red spots. And a 150-year-old bottle of beer is going to be opened and used to brew a new concoction. Allsop's Arctic Ale, brewed in 1875, was formulated to fortify Victorian explorers against the chill of the Arctic. It is 9% ABV. Dougal Gun Sharp, master brewer at Innison Gun, bought a bottle for just over £3,000 more than a decade ago. He's told Times Radio he expects the flavour of the original to be deep and complex.
I haven't personally tasted it yet. I'm really looking forward to trying it. But you can see online where people have opened and tried bottles in the past, and apparently it tastes like a strong sherry or a Madeira. I guess that's what happens if you age a beer for 150 years.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, how do you make sure that we're all and always safe from being attacked on a train by a maniac with a knife? You can't. Obviously, there is no such thing as total safety from harm. No government minister wants to state the obvious as obviously as that, and their opponents would probably pile into a minister that tried. I ask this, by the way, without prejudice to what happened or didn't happen at the weekend, but what can you do to make us a lot safer than we are? Well, airport-type scanners and searches at railway stations. What an absurd idea, unless you want to bring rail travel to a grinding halt. And what about police stop and searches of passengers across the rail network? Well, is that hardly more practical or effective? Police can't cope with more normal so-called crime, everyday crime, like shoplifting, as it is. And violent crime has gone down, by the way. There is also the question, do you want Britain to be a country where police at countless railway stations frequently stop and search men who somehow look as if they might just maybe look suspicious? Often, presumably, the wrong colour, perhaps, or the wrong type, because who else would be targeted? Well, it's no answer just to say don't worry. It might be useful to have a rational conversation then, shorn of panic and malice and political point scoring and guided by facts, don't you think? It's not a rhetorical question. I want to know what you are thinking. And we're going to be weighing the reaction of our political leaders and their opponents a little bit later on. The Home Secretary is due to report on the Huntingdon attack in the Commons a little later, and we'll be bringing that to you live. What are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Meanwhile, now, Cambridgeshire police are saying the suspect in the Huntingdon train attack is being linked to three earlier knife-related incidents in Peterborough at the weekend. Two were at a barber's shop. A 14-year-old boy was stabbed in the third. Now, 32-year-old Anthony Williams has been charged with 10 attempted murders, and we're expecting a statement from the Home Secretary in the next half hour or so. Speaking to Times Radio Breakfast this morning, the Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, insisted train travel is safe.
This won't mean much for those people who were on that train on Saturday night, but the railways are one of the safest forms of public transport that we have. It is a low-crime environment generally. For every 1 million passenger journeys that are made, it's 27 crimes are committed. So 27 crimes for every 1 million passenger journeys.
Heidi Alexander there. And the Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Phelps, explained why he believed there's a need for surge policing in hotspots.
If you talk to the families of people who have been victims of knife crime, they will say, I wish my son or daughter's killer had been stopped and searched on the way to the place where they were killed. They might still be alive today if that had happened. There is, in my view, insufficient focus given to this issue. There isn't enough force being applied to it. Yeah. We should be looking to clear knives off our streets completely. And if we did that, we wouldn't see these 250-odd knife-enabled murders per year.
It's the Conservative spokesman, Chris Phelps. Now, first, let's welcome Danny Shaw, the policing and crime commentator. Welcome back to the show, Danny.
Good evening, Sean. Hi.
Hi. What can you tell us about these three incidents that have been related to the other man being charged today?
Well, this is an unexpected development in the last few hours. The suspect has already appeared in court, charged with 10 attempted murders and one actual bodily harm and one possession of a knife in relation to the knife attack on the train, and also one attempted murder and one possession of an offensive weapon in relation to an incident that happened in the early hours of Saturday morning in southeast London at Silvertown at a train station there. So already I think there's a question about what happened in the 18 or so intervening hours between that incident and then the knife attack on the train. And now we learn that there have been several incidents allegedly linked to Anthony Williams, which Cambridgeshire Police are reviewing. On the Friday night, the 31st of October, a man was seen with a knife at a barber's at Fletton in Peterborough. That happened at around about 7:30 on Friday, but was reported to police.